All right, we got one station with an open key. I don't know if they were involved in Mount St. Helens or not. If there was anybody that had any interaction with Mount St. Helens or was involved in any way, either directly or indirectly, and you want to let us know, come on in quickly before I get into all these details. This is Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-Ray.
I'll take a look and see what... just another comment quickly, but I didn't notice this, but some of my friends walking to school that morning, I'm going to say it was around 10 after 8 or something in the morning, Vancouver time or West Coast time, heard it, or sometime thereafter heard it, but it was a little delayed, right, because it took time for the sound to travel from Mount St. Helens up Vancouver, but a number of people said they heard it up here.
Oh, yeah, it was an absolutely huge acoustic blast, so that's not a... people heard it all over the place. It was heard within about 500 kilometers of the volcano itself, so it was out there. Okay, cool. Well, thanks for that, Adrian. We'll get some more input from you in a little bit. Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray 4ID. All right, so let's get into the nitty-gritty here. So Mount St. Helens, it's a prominent stratovolcano, and it's located in southwestern Washington State, and it's approximately 50 miles northeast of Portland, Oregon, and it's part of the Cascade Range, which is a chain of volcanic peaks that stretch from B.C. all the way down to Northern California. So the lake itself, or the volcano itself, has Spirit Lake, which is located directly north of the volcano. Now, I'll get into it again, but Spirit Lake was completely changed by the volcano. It moved, actually, a little bit, and things changed with it. There was Coldwater Lake, which formed from debris from the volcano when the avalanches associated blocked the Coldwater Creek, so it became Coldwater Lake. And then there's Castle Lake, which is near the volcano as well, and that was created by an impounded blockage in the South Fork Castle Creek, again, after the eruption. And the Swift Reservoir, which is a human-made lake on the Lewis River, and it receives drainage from Mount St. Helens via Swift Creek, Pine Creek, and the Muddy River. And just to give an idea of some other volcanoes in the Cascade Range, you have Mount Rainier, Mount Adams, Glacier Peak, Mount Baker. Those ones are in Washington. Mount Hood, that one's in Oregon, and Mount Jefferson, which is also in Oregon. And there's a few towns and cities that surround it. The closest is going to be Cougar, Washington. That's a small unincorporated community in Cowlitz County, and it's basically the southern gateway to Mount St. Helens. And then there's Tootle, Washington, and this is near the north and south forks of the Tootle River. Castle Rock, Washington, which is near the Cowlitz River, not that that means anything to you, and Woodland, Washington. There's also Kelso, Longview, and of course then Portland, which is the major metropolitan area. That's about 50 miles to the southwest of the volcano. So before I get into it, let's talk about some of the components of different types of volcanoes. There are different types of volcanoes, shield volcanoes, stratovolcanoes, composite volcanoes, cinder cones, et cetera, but they all tend to share the same geological components. Now, I have to go back to one of my university textbooks. So while I'm not a volcanologist or anything, I'm not a volcanologist, seismologist, geologist, etc., part of the course requirement that I was required to take for meteorology, just to be well-rounded, was some sort of a geophysical science. So I said, oh, okay, well, I'm going to do some, I'll do geology, and of course, it was a very broad form of geology, but they rolled in volcanoes. So I had these textbooks that I was able to take out and read and go through, and I was like, oh, hey, look, I'm using this information again. So it was a good thing I didn't sell my university textbooks. They've come in handy. So the components of a volcano are the magma chamber. It's an underground reservoir, partially molten rock beneath the Earth's surface, and it's basically the engine of the volcano. That's where all the magma collects. As well as accumulating dissolved gases collect over there. And don't forget, magma is less dense than the surrounding solid rock, so that causes it to rise towards the surface, and as that happens, the pressure gets lower, and you have outgassing, and that aggravates everything, and it makes it want to achieve more buoyancy, so it wants to go up. Conduit, that's sort of the main vent. That's the, primary pipe-like channel the passage where everything goes through to get to the top of the magma chamber, or to go from the magma chamber to the surface, I should say, and it's basically the throat of the volcano. There's no specific size. The conduit or the main vent, it can be narrow, it can be wide, its shape can change, but that's all part of the geographic. Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray 4ID. So those are the first primary components of the volcano. Then you also have the vents, and those are the openings at the Earth's surface, and that's where volcanic material, lava, gas, ash, etc., comes through. Summit vent is typically the big one. It's the main opening at the top of the volcano. Then you have secondary vents, also known as flank vents, that form on the side of the volcano, right? And then the crater, that's typically the bowl-shaped depression at the summit of most volcanoes. Not all volcanoes have it, but most volcanoes do, and that's directly surrounding the main vent. And it's formed by the upward explosion and collapse of the volcano's upper structure during an eruption, right? Craters can, you know, they can have all sorts of sizes, and they can vary from a few meters to several kilometers across. You also have the volcanic edifice, or the cone slash mountain. So in the case of Mount St. Helens, it was conical, it was very uniform, it was capped off. And that's the visible above ground structure of the volcano. So when people say, oh, there's a volcano, that's typically what they're referring to. And obviously the cone changes. You have lava flows, you have tephra, pyroclastic material, pyroclastic floors, lahars, all these things change the shape of the edifice or the cone. But when a volcano is either dormant or in a period of reduced activity or altogether dead, that'll also change the structure of it. Mount St. Helens, it was just in a period, prior to 1980, it was in a period of reduced activity after it had a period of greater activity in the mid-1850s. Anyway, and then of course you have layers of erupted material on the mountain, and especially with stratovolcanoes like Mount St. Helens, the edifice is composed of alternating layers of solidified lava flows and pyroclastic material. That changes the rock composition. And there's two other things that most people don't realize that exist. Dikes and sills, these are basically intrusions. These are places where dikes are, you know, what happens is the magma solidifies and it causes in vertical cracks and fissures that cut across. So that's where magma will solidify. Those are called dikes. So if you were able to slice into a rock and you saw that, that would be a dike. And sills are magma that intrudes horizontally between layers of existing rock. So that's basically where the magma tries to, both dikes and sills are areas where the magma tries to get to the surface, but it never does. It solidifies before it can. And fumaroles, those are small openings or cracks on the volcano's flanks or crater floor that emit volcanic gases and steam, often between eruptions. You never hear about fumaroles, but they're a significant component. Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray 4ID. So volcanoes are typically classified by their shape and their eruption style, right? So shape, you can also refer to it as their morphology. So you have the main types are shield volcanoes. So those are broad, gently sloping domes, and they sort of resemble a warrior shield laying on the ground. They have very wide bases and relatively low profiles, and their magma is primarily basaltic lava, so it has low silica, low viscosity, and their eruptions are typically effusive, so they're not explosive per se, and the lava flows easily and often for long distances, building up, you know, really thin layers. So an example would be Mauna Loa and Kilauea in Hawaii. And some of the volcanoes on Iceland would be shield volcanoes. So these are sort of the classic volcanoes people think about. Composite volcanoes, which are also known as stratovolcanoes, they're tall, symmetrical, conical mountains, and they typically have steep slopes and a crater at the summit, although not always the case. But they're sort of the classic volcano shape. And their magma type, it can vary, but it's typically intermediate. And so it's andesitic to rhyolitic, and that means that they have a higher silica content and a higher viscosity, and of course their eruption style can alternate between explosive eruptions and effusive flows, right? So they can have lava coming out, and then sometimes they go boom, and get a huge explosion out of it. some other examples other than Mount St. Helens would be Mount Fuji, Mount Vesuvius, the famous Mount Vesuvius, and Mount Rainier. And what's important with them for their tectonic setting is that they're most commonly found at the convergent plate boundaries. So these are subduction zones, right, where things are going down. Whereas shield volcanoes, they're often found at divergent plate boundaries, right? So those are usually oceanic hotspots. So you have plates moving away from each other where you get shield volcanoes and the opposite with composite volcanoes. There are two other types, cinder cone volcanoes and lava dome volcanoes. You don't really see too many of those, but just as an example, a cinder cone would be Sunset Crater in Arizona, and a lava dome volcano would be Mount Pelee in Martinique. And sometimes those are found with the craters of composite volcanoes as well, the lava dome volcanoes. And then you get other volcanic classifications, but they're more broad, like super volcanoes. That would be used to discuss a VEI 8 type volcano. And on that note, the VEI scale, real quick, because we'll make reference of it. So the VEI scale stands for the Volcanic Explosivity Index. And that's a scale used to measure the size and explosivity of volcanic eruptions. And it was developed in 1982 by Chris Newhall from the U.S. Geological Survey and Stephen Self of the University of Hawaii. And it was very timely. They were working on developing it prior to Mount St. Helens. It was completed after Mount St. Helens, but Mount St. Helens actually did play a crucial role in its development. But basically, it's a logarithmic scale, similar to the Richter scale for earthquakes, and it goes from 0 to 8. And that means that each increase of one number on the scale generally represents a tenfold increase in the explosivity of the eruption. So with some exceptions at the lower ends of the scale. But the criteria uses for determination, it uses multiple factors, so the volume of ejected material, also known as tephra ash, the eruption cloud height, how high does it get up there, qualitative observations, so things like, you know, was it a gentle eruption or did it blow all the doors and windows out of the place? And typically a VEI 0, that would be a non-explosive eruption. That's effusive lava flows with very little, ejected material. And a VEI 8 would be a mega-colossal supervolcano that ejects 1,000 cubic kilometers of tephra, so ash and stuff. And that can have an eruption column over 50 kilometers high. Just as a note, the, Tonga Tonga eruption, that one was between 54 and 56 kilometers in altitude. So, and that one would have actually been more powerful than Mount St. Helens. Unfortunately, there was nothing around. I mean, the islands of Hunga Tonga were affected, and they were far away. But had anybody been at the same distance as Mount St. Helens, they would have been absolutely obliterated. And just to give you some real-world examples over here, Mount St. Helens, that would have been a VEI 5. The 1883 eruption of Krakatoa, that would have been a VEI 6. And the 1815 eruption of Mount Tambora, that's one of the largest actually in recent history, that would have been a VEI 7. So those are big. And then, of course, Yellowstone, the Yellowstone Caldera, that one erupted 631,000 years ago. That would have been a VEI 8. So there you have it. And there's some other scales. Volcanic alert levels, those are VALs, and they typically use color codes, and then they'll use some other eruption scale classifications, depending on the local environment, like a Hawaiian, Strombolian, Volcanian, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to get into all those details, but those are some other types. Victor Alpha 3, Victor with the X-ray. Any comments or questions about the scales before we move on?
Break, N6DT.
Station break. I believe it was November 6th, Delta Charlie. This is Victor Alpha 3, Victor with the X-ray. Come on in.
Oh, hi, good evening. Yeah, this is Rick. It's November 6th, Delta Tango. My call at that time, I lived in Castle Rock, Washington, which was at essentially I-5, And the Toutle River there in Castle Rock, east of or west of the mountain, was there when it blew up and kind of helped out for a few days in the disaster relief.
It must have. What did you see when you got there? I was earlier. I was asking if anybody was on the net that actually participated in some capacity with Mount St. Helens, and you're the first one. We had Adrian, VE7NZ, who was with his picture going to California, and their car had some issues when it sucked in. The air intake took in some ashes that had been deposited. But yeah, what did you experience when you were volunteering? Go ahead.
I actually lived in Castle Rock, which was a reference point is at the Toutle River and Interstate 5, and I was actually operating the disaster center in Castle Rock and was there for essentially from the time the mountain blew. I opened up the center at about 11 o'clock in the morning and was there until Friday about 2 in the afternoon.
Did you have, now for you, you were good. You were outside of the ash cloud. Did you have many people come through? Because Castle Rock is, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that that is the largest town with direct proximity to the volcano. Like St. Helens, Kid Valley, Toutle, those were all much smaller. So Castle Rock would have been the largest at that distance. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct. Castle Rock is located west of Mount St. Helens, and we lived there. So we saw the initial eruption, felt the earthquake outside the house, and early morning that morning, you could not see the eruption. It was about 10 o'clock, 10:30 in the morning, and the sky started clearing, so you could see the plume of ash and smoke going up from the volcano. And what was interesting, what was fascinating, of course, we see huge boulders going up in the air that are probably the size of a house. But blow went for a long time, and so it melted the snow off. But when it got down, the Toutle River was boiling, got to the Kellis River, and it's actually boiling. That was along our property line. And we're watching this thing, and I was given permission to cross the bridge into the town, and I lived in Castle Rock itself, but went up and opened up a disaster center inside the Catholic Church, and we processed about 150 people. Most of them were local people. We had a few that were flown in with National Guard people that were dropped off, but the bulk of them were helped out with people with four-wheel drive and such, just because roads were cut off and it was a big mess. Didn't have any of the ash on the initial blow, but the next week, I believe it was the next Friday, we had a blow, and the second blow that we had wasn't anywhere near as big as the first one, but we got the ash cloud that time. And so I set up with a Washington State Patrolman up at the Chevron station at the Castle Rock at I-5 I can't think of any name of the road there. But anyway, we sat there at the off there underneath a canopy, and actually I was relaying for him because during the ash cloud, the Washington State Patrol lost their communication. This is N6DT for ID.
November 6th, Delta Tango. Yes, thanks for that. That's an amazing first-hand account. This is Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-Ray. Everything you spoke about, I have over here. We're going to cover it. We're going to discuss the ash cloud and how it affected radio. And I actually have a whole section over here dedicated to amateur radio and the role it played in the entire event, and as well as a couple operators that lost their lives, sadly, and some other individuals of significance. But it's always incredible to get first-hand accounts, especially since you were there, you were in your home, and you were essentially jostled from the first explosion.
Yeah, when the volcano exploded, we didn't hear any sound. There wasn't any sound, but we felt a fairly good earthquake. And it was a sharp snap. Woke up my wife and I, and so we're just walking around. And earthquakes were not that common, but we knew there was things going up the mountain. So went outside, was looking around, what happened was I actually drove over to town. We were heading over to church in the morning. We got there, and by that time, the Washington State Patrol and the county sheriffs were out, and they stopped us because they wanted to cross the bridge, but I had my ham radio placed on the car, and so they asked me to give a call into the county, and the county was activating the disaster center, still ramping up. Since I lived there, made sure my family was safe, and I went over and sat for 7 days at the Catholic Church. We probably processed there at about, I'm going to say around 100 people. Most of them were just people living in outlying areas, but we're just spent most of the time just making sure that we knew who we had in under the roof, and updating lists of missing, and that went on throughout the first 3 or 4 days, 24/7.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, I don't know what to say. It's great that you have such a. It's wonderful when we have people in the science center that have a direct firsthand account, because that really humanizes the story. And especially, I mean, I find it incredible that we just so happen to have you, who's basically beside the volcano there. You're the closest population point and setting up for the church. That's fascinating. So you know what? If you're still around, hopefully you will be, when I get into the amateur radio section, I think it would be great if you'd come in and discuss some of the, maybe in a little more detail, some of the messages and things that you relayed, if possible.
Sure, that's no problem. What I'll try to do is come in on, I'm coming in through my repeater phone here, and I'll see if I can get you on ClearNode, and it might be a little bit better, a little better audio quality.
Okay, QSL, well, yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll be here, so you can come in direct through the node when you're ready to do so. Okay, thanks for that. This is Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-Ray. Okay, so let's get into it. So Mount St. Helens, of course, it's a stratovolcano, as I previously mentioned, which is also known as a composite volcano, and it's located in the Pacific Northwest in the state of Washington. It's a volcano that's very old. It has a long history. The volcano's history begins about 275,000 years ago. And that was a period marked by diverse ranges of eruptions. It was relatively quiet at times and had effusive lava flows, and it became highly violent, and it would go back and forth. The earliest documented ash deposits around the volcano go back to about 40,000 years. And what's important to note is that the visible cone that defined Mount St. Helens before the 1980 eruption is actually very young. That cone is only believed to have formed about 2,200 years ago. And prior to 1980, it had a series of nine distinct pulses of volcanic activity as they broken into various phases and eras. And some of them lasted less than 100 years, and some of them, you know, it was about 5,000 years between or so.
VE7NZ?
VE7NZ, come on in.
Yeah, hey Tom, just kind of an admin thing. I'm trying to kill VE3SKY, which I think you control, actually. And I've been disconnecting and disconnecting. Every time I disconnect it, it gets reconnected. But it's got a pulse back, and like a repeater hang time pulse back. And every time anybody unkeys, it pulses back and keys up the whole network. And this is causes people, particularly on it, not be able to transmit and get into the net. So I don't know if there's any way if you can stop it doing that, but... if it's easy to do, great. If not, I have no other solution. I can't seem to stop it connecting in.
All right, I've got bad news, and I've got good news and bad news about that. The good news is Phil, VE3GFK, GFX. Phil is on. He's got control over that. The bad news is Ken is coming through that because the WOO machine is down. So there's good and bad there. Does that clarify it?
Okay, we'll just leave it as it is then. And just happy to help if I can help resolve that pulse back. I know the setting to fix that, and happy to help the admin of that repeater help solve it later. Send me an email, v7nz at myrec.ca. And yep, all good then. If Ken needs it, that's all good. Just maybe you'll have to leave a longer pause, which you've been doing, to invite people in, just because Echolink people need to have a clear frequency for a second or two before they can actually key up. Okay, carry on. Sorry for the admin public service announcement. V7NZ.
Yeah, no problem, Adrian. I'll hook you up with Phil over there. And yeah, I've been leaving a pause because it's been going here too. I don't know. It was good earlier, but it started doing that pulse back thing. Okay, thank you. Okay, so the periods that they had were the Ape Canyon stage. That was 275,000 to 35,000 years ago. That's the earliest eruptive period. Had the Cougar stage, 28,000 to 18,000 years ago. That was one of the most explosive periods. The Swift Creek stage, that was 12,800 years ago. I have it written down as 12.8 kA. That's 1,000 years. 12,800 years ago. And that was a relatively short stage and had multiple domes and eruptions and stuff then. The Smith Creek eruptive period, that's 3,900 to about 3,300 years ago. And the Castle Creek eruptive period, that's about 2,000 to 1,700 years ago. And that period involved the formation of dacite domes accompanied by tephra, pyroclastic flows, and lava flows. And recent studies have basically identified three basaltic eruptions during that entire period. And that's likely what helped really generate elevation within Mount St. Helens. That period, the Castle Creek period, is what built the dome up to the summit elevation before the eruption, which was 8,000 feet or about 2,450 meters. And there was two other periods, the Kalma eruptive period, that's 1479 to 1720, and then the Goat Rocks eruptive period. And this is an interesting period because it was verbally through oral tradition, it was documented by different First Nations groups within North America at the time. So there's lots of stories about Mount St. Helens within First Nations groups. But the Goat Rocks eruptive period, which is 1800 to 1857, that was the most recent pre-1980 period. And that was also the last volcano was last volcanic activity of significance was about 1850. Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray. So, what happened? Well, there was a prelude, basically, to the catastrophic May 18th eruption, and it was characterized by a sequence of events and structural changes that occurred, and the first indications of this occurring emerged on March 16th, 1980, and there was a series of small earthquakes. The seismic activity intensified, and within about a week, there were hundreds of earthquakes that were recorded, and then it got up to about 20 earthquakes per hour by March 24th. And by May 17th, the volcano had been shaken by more than 10,000 earthquakes. So following the intense seismic activity that started around March 27, Mount St. Helens produced its first eruption in over a century. And the initial event was basically a steam blast that created a crater that was 60 to 75 meters, that's 200 to 250 feet wide in diameter. And within about a week, that crater expanded to about 400 meters, that's 1,300 feet in diameter, and there were two extensive crack systems that developed across the entire summit area. And the real big thing that geologists noticed, aside from the other stuff, was that there was a big structural change that was observed in April, and it was the rapid and continuous development of this prominent bulge that's on the northern flank of the volcano. Let me drop it. So, prior to the ScienceNet last week, and prior to that, I was watching all these. There's tons and tons of great video on YouTube now with Mount St. Helens. There's original newscasts from the day it erupted. There's recaps. There's videos from the U.S. Forest Service, the Geological Service, etc. And there's there's all this gray stuff. And in the pictures, you can visibly see this bulge developing on the volcano. And this is what this critical change was. So you had this rapid and continuous development of this big bulge on the northern flank of the mountain, and the deformation was really substantial. It measured 1.24 miles, so that's 1.99 kilometers long, and 0.62 miles, that's 0.99 kilometers wide. And it had an expansion rate of about 4.9 feet, that's 1.49 meters per day. And by May 17th, the northern flank had protruded outwards by at least 140 meters, which is 450 feet. So it had significant outward growth, and this was basically strong evidence that the volcano was filling with molten rock and magma, and that everything was ascending towards the surface, and there was immense pressure that was forming against that rock edifice, right, that outer part of the volcanic shield. So watching this growing bulge was really what was alarming volcanologists, because at this point in time they said, okay, you know, it sounds terrible, but this would be like watching a pimple grow or a balloon filling with water. You know that eventually it's going to pop. The question, of course, was when is it going to pop? What's going to happen? What kind of an eruption is it going to be? So they were looking at this bulge, and it was serving as a real-time indicator of an impending eruption, rather than just, you know, steam activity and stuff that they had seen earlier. What was important for this was that they were trying to figure out, you know, how the rock was holding up and what all the seismic activity in addition to this bulging meant, and if they could interpolate some sort of a timeline from this. And, of course, even today, if you talk to any volcanologists, they'll say, well, you know, we don't know. And in all fairness, it's very difficult. We can predict the weather, but predicting volcanic eruptions, even when you can see a chain of events unfolding that ultimately says, hey, there's going to be an eruption, it's basically at this point in time still impossible to say, yeah, this volcano is going to go off at 8:30 Monday morning. We can't do that. We'll say, well, maybe in the next 2 weeks to a month, maybe. Could be longer. I don't know. And that's typically what happens. Now, what was also interesting and unusual was that while this bulge was really filling up, what they noticed was that between May 15th and May 18th, the earthquakes that were rattling Mount St. Helens began to rapidly diminish. And what they suspect is that as the volcano basically swelled with molten rock, this was basically stabilizing everything in a weird way and absorbing the vibrations. So think about it like this. Imagine you have a crumpled up plastic bag, right? When you first start pumping air into the bag, it's going to sort of unroll, and then all the crinkles will pop, and it's going to be very active. But as the bag is nearing its maximum capacity, not much happens. It tends to just bulge out, but you're not hearing any popping or crinkling. And this is sort of the same thing that may have been happening with Mount St. Helens. As it was nearing that point where it was about to erupt, there just wasn't much room for motion anymore within the mountain itself, right? Everything was stretched to the point where it couldn't really stretch anymore, and this is why all the seismic activity began to ease off substantially. Now, this is really important because prior to this point in time, see, Mount St. Helens was one of the most detailed and most studied volcanoes. Prior to Mount St. Helens, most of the volcanoes that we were dealing with or that geologists and volcanologists were dealing with would have been like what you see in Hawaii, or they would have been more substantial volcanoes but in far-off places with, you know, where you didn't have the same degree of development within the country, and they were harder to monitor, et cetera, et cetera. Mount St. Helens, you had it in the U.S. The USGS at that point in time was given a lot of federal money because they're, okay, what's going on with the volcano? So they were able to place sensors all over. And don't forget, this is 1980. It's not today. Today it's easy to pepper a volcano with sensors. It's easy. In 1980, it was a lot harder because the sensors were bigger. The technology was in many ways more expensive, and the relay networks weren't the same, right? If you think about of oscillators for microwave frequencies and stuff, they were much more difficult to manufacture and generate in the 1980s, whereas today, you know, you can get gigahertz oscillators for, you know, they're a dime a dozen, so it's very easy. So prior to Mount St. Helens, there were some predefined or pre-prescribed ideas of what would happen with a volcano. Mount St. Helens actually changed some of that, and the earthquake is part of it. Let me drop it. So, again, just quickly going back to the earthquake. Seismologists were watching it, and the earthquakes were going down, and that actually lured some people into a false sense that, hey, maybe activity is decreasing, and in fact, the volcano's not going to erupt, right? Well, we're seeing a change. I mean, it's bulging, but the earthquake activity seems to be going down. And that sort of, there were mixed feelings on that at the time within the community. However, we now know, courtesy of Mount St. Helens, that, hey, if you see a sudden drop-off in this activity, it doesn't necessarily mean that the volcano's going to imminently explode. But what it does mean is that there's a heap ton of pressure there, and there's a very good chance you're getting close to the eruption point. So that's one of the takeaways. So let's talk about the cataclysmic eruption on May 18th. So it was a bright Sunday morning where the volcano was, and fortunately the skies, there was a little bit of haze, but it actually cleared out right around the volcano. And this was important because it allowed people a decent view of the volcano. I know that our other station was saying that it was sort of cloudy where he was in Castle Rock. He didn't have a good view. But for other stations that were positioned, or for other observers, I should say, pardon me, that were positioned closer to the volcano, they actually had a good view. And it was fortunate enough that it wasn't a deep blue sky, but it was a clear enough sky, blue enough sky, that it created some good contrast between any clouds, pyroclastic or ash clouds from the volcano and the blue sky. Had it been gray and cloudy or foggy, it would have been much more difficult to observe the volcano. So the weather actually worked in the favor of analyzing this eruption. So on Sunday morning at 8:32 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time, there was a sudden magnitude 5.1 earthquake that struck the volcano. And the event was a direct catalyst for what later unfolded within seconds. Then about 15 to 20 seconds after the earthquake, don't forget, a 5.1 is a pretty big earthquake, the volcano, which was at this point in time overpressurized basically, the northern bulge and the entire summit of the volcano collapsed in a huge landslide. And this landslide was just not big. It was actually the largest debris avalanche that we've ever recorded on Earth. Yes, there have been bigger ones in the past, but this is the first one that we've actually been able to record as it happened and quantify directly. So that's insane. The landslide removed the bulge and the upper 1,312 feet, that's 400 meters of the volcano, and it reduced the summit elevation from its pre-eruption height of 9,677 feet, that's 2,949 meters, down to 8,363 feet. And the landslide came down rapidly, and it transformed into a debris avalanche, and that surged down into the North Fork Tuttle River, and that reached speeds between 68 and 87 miles an hour, so that's 109 to about 140 kilometers an hour. And it traveled 14 miles, that's 22 kilometers, to the west. And it was just this huge wall of material, and it had a cubic volume of about 2.67 cubic kilometers, that's about 0.64 cubic miles. And that completely removed the volcano's northern flank, and that depressurized everything. And then the underlying magma, that initiated a powerful eruption. So as the landslide was making its way, again, we're talking about a time scale of seconds over here, as the landslide was going down to the debris, the phenomenon that scientists, the explosion, this phenomenon scientists refer to as the lateral blast, so that's the blowout of the side of the mountain, and that's where basically you had the ejection of hot rock, you had ash coming out, you had gases, volcanic gases, and steam, and they were blowing upward and outward to the north. And that blast, so again, as the landslide was coming down, eventually this pressure blast basically cut through the landslide, what was still up there, And that blast was moving at about 483 kilometers per hour. That's over 300 miles an hour. And that took out an area of about 230 square miles or 600 square kilometers. That blast took out a huge area. And it had an inner zone of about 6 miles, 10 kilometers from the summit, where no trees remained. Everything was blown down in that entire area. And this is where the immediate first fatalities from the volcano occurred. And beyond this immediate blast area, all the trees were blown down, and the temperatures with this lateral blast got as high as about 660 Fahrenheit or 350 degrees Celsius. And this blast is believed to have released an estimated 24 megatons of thermal energy. So the blast cloud itself extended about 17 miles, 27.4 kilometers northward from the volcano. So approximately 30 seconds to a minute after the lateral blast, there was a very strong vertical directed. If you look at the, there's a sequence of photos, and in the sequence of photos, you can see the vertical blast beginning shortly after this lateral blast, that basically where the side of the mountain blew away. And that's the one that created the big vertical ash cloud and volcanic plumage that we see in some of the photos. So that column, the vertical column, rose really, really quickly. It got to an altitude of about 15 miles, that's 24 kilometers or 80,000 feet, in just 15 minutes. And the plume top ranged, so initially when it was getting up there, and again, there's inversions in the atmosphere, so we'll fan out a little at each inversion. The initial diameter of the anvil for this column was 8.5 to 11 miles, and it spread out to cover an area much bigger than that. It was approximately, the diameter of the cloud was about 300 miles at its peak, the ash cloud. So after the initial explosion, and you had this giant ash cloud pouring out of the volcano, about noon, this is when all these pyroclastic flows began. There were these avalanches of hot ash, pumice, and gas, which are basically pyroclastic flows, and they come out of the equator. The crater, not the equator. They come out of the crater at the top of the volcano, and they can move at about 50 to 80 miles an hour. That's basically 80 to 130 kilometers an hour. And these pyroclastic flows, they spread out about 5 miles, 8 kilometers to the north of the volcano. And they form that distinctive pumice plain that you can see in satellite images. You guys can Google that. And the depth of some of these pyroclastic flows were between 30 and 120 feet. And the temperature within these pyroclastic flows got up to about 700 degrees Celsius or 1300 degrees Fahrenheit. And that would have been their peak temperature. And scientists believe that the pyroclastic flows coming out of the volcano peaked between 3 and 5 p.m. that same day, so on May 18th. This is Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray 4ID. And just to put this in perspective, the immediate effects of the volcano's eruption were that 57 people died, and I'll deal with this shortly. These included volcanologist David A. Johnson. He was the one that sent out the Vancouver, this is it radio message that was actually listened to by ham radio operators and then relayed. And there were some other photographers and a ham radio operator that died. And beyond the human casualties, so 57 people there, it's believed that there was a lot of wildlife mortality. They think about 7,000 big game animals were killed, and about 12 million fingerlings and hatcheries were also killed. And the estimated damages would have been about $1 billion. 200 homes and cabins were either swallowed or completely destroyed, and lahars, which are volcanic mud flows, so don't forget it's melting all the snow and ice on the top of the summit, and it's coming down and it's blasting through existing rivers and tributaries. these mud flows were taking out transportation networks, 299 kilometers worth of highways. That's 186 miles of highways and roads were destroyed, and numerous. I think there was approximately 15 major bridges and 85 minor bridges were destroyed by this, including numerous private bridges. So if you remember earlier I spoke about Spirit Lake. So that was a lake that was located about 8 miles from the summit, and it was significantly altered. What happened was, as the debris flow from the initial blast entered the lake, it blocked the lake's outlet, and it also displaced the water in the lake. So if you think about it, if you have a swimming pool and you take a bulldozer and you pile a bunch of gravel in your swimming pool, it doesn't just go in there. You displace the water, right? The water is going to rise because you've increased the entire volume of that swimming pool, right? So the water is going to go up as it's displaced by the rock. So the exact same thing was happening with Spirit Lake. So what happened with Spirit Lake was that it actually rose by 197 feet, and the lake, the entire shoreline of the lake shifted. So 197 feet is approximately 60 meters. So the entire lake changed and shifted in an instant. And in the blast area, they're estimating that something like 4 million board feet of timber flew into the body of Spirit Lake itself, and of course the Toodle Valley was buried under ash and debris, and some of the ash and debris depth ranged as much as 165 feet or 50.3 meters deep. This is Victor Alpha 3, Victor with the X-ray 4ID, and my dog is saying hi to my wife, who just came home from a concert. Let me cycle it. And some of the other effects outside of the immediate blast zone, etc., were that there were detectable amounts of ash that covered an area of 22,000 square miles, that's 57,000 square kilometers. And the areas that were greatest affected by the ash were 300 miles downwind, so that was basically to the east-northeast of Mount St. Helens. And some places there had a couple inches of ash accumulate. But because of the nature of ash, it's very problematic. Obviously, it's very problematic with jet aircraft engines. Those engines are hot enough to remelt it and then clog up the engines. But it's also very abrasive. So it's terrible for any type of motorized engine that has an air intake. It's terrible for anywhere where there's a bearing and friction can occur. It's difficult to breathe in, and then if you get rain on it, it'll turn into this muddy concrete-like substance. So it's not good for people and machinery and stuff like that, at least not initially. And it's estimated that the entire timber loss from Mount St. Helens was 4.7 billion board feet of timber. So that's a lot of timber. So, yeah. As far as the environmental recovery and ecological resilience go, this is what I found very interesting. So initially scientists thought that, okay, the entire ecosystem around the volcano was gone. They described it as a moonscape. But what they ended up discovering was that many burrowing mammals, like the pocket gopher, they survived. Because the blast occurred during daytime, pocket gophers were basically underground, so they were, obviously they felt it, but they weren't killed by anything. So they emerged once the activity subsided, and they served an important role because they burrow in and out of the ground. They actually mix the subsurface material with the ash, and this actually helps get some of the richer soil up to the surface, and plants are able to gain a foothold. Also, trees that they thought were dead in some cases weren't actually dead, and new sprouts came off of root balls and things like that. Let me cycle it. And because there was still ice on some of the lakes in the areas, the animals that were actually within the ice cover were partially protected. Insects came back to the area, to the immediately destroyed blast areas. within several months of the activity subsiding. And they noticed that various amphibians and reptiles, they survived the blast because they were protected either by being underground or protected by that ice cover that I mentioned. And they actually returned to the area. What didn't initially return was the fish in the various lakes. Wind was blowing around the seeds, so that helped to bring vegetation back. There were spores, fungi, and then various flora and fauna came back, and there was a large diversification within the environment. And then in the late 90s, what I should clarify is that what the USGS decided to do is they decided to say, hey, we're not going to forcibly try and restore the area impacted by the explosion. What they did is they created a nature preserve around Mount St. Helens, and they said, we're going to watch it and figure out how nature recovers, because obviously this thing had blown up numerous times in the past, and it had recovered, and this was the first time that it would be a good experiment in a way to see how long it would take for nature to recover. That way we have a good solid estimate rather than a guesstimate. So what happened was in the late 90s, all of a sudden, fish appeared in, fish appeared in, sorry, let me cycle this. Victor Alpha 3, Victor with CX-ray. So sorry about that. Fish appeared in Spirit Lake. Now, these were, they weren't salmon, they were trout. It's suspected that somebody who was not authorized to do so introduced trout to Spirit Lake. And what they noticed was that, so Spirit Lake in the initial days after the blast, days and weeks after the blast, was contaminated. The pH in the lake was highly acidic. It wasn't good for anything, right? And most of the, all the marine life within the lake basically died. So all the fish that were in the lake died. The other thing is it was covered in all this deadwood, right? So the deadwood was blocking out the sunshine. Of course, like I mentioned before, some amphibians and reptiles, they survived, and they were able to move to parts of the lake that were a little bit more hospitable, but generally the lake died. But what happened was it was taken over by bacteria, and there were various blooms with the bacteria, and then eventually the lake began to clear itself out and recover, and the bacterial levels dropped off, and marine plants began to reestablish themselves in Spirit Lake, and then the lake returned to normalcy within about 10 years. And then in the 90s, they discovered that somebody had introduced trout into the lake. And the trout were eating really well. There were no other fish in the lake, and the lake had now been cut off from the river that was feeding it. So it was an isolated lake, so there's no way for fish to get in there. And what ended up happening was these fish were, at the age of 3, they were about the size of trout that would normally be 5 years old. But unusually, their life was quite short. Very few of the fish made it to age 5. They would sort of die before that. And scientists were trying to figure out why that was. Stand by. Victor Alpha 3, Victor with the extra 4ID. So they were trying to figure out why. They never really got an answer as to why these fish were living shorter lives, but they were living really well. And I was trying to figure that out, but I never really did get an answer on that in my research. But that was an interesting takeaway. And in the satellite imagery, while it still sort of looks barren at the surface, what they're expecting now is that within 60 years of 2019, so do the math on that, they're expecting that the forest will be back to the point where it was prior to the 1980 explosion. So everything will be basically unrecognizable as far as being a moonscape. So in that case, it takes approximately 80 years for an environment that's been decimated by a volcanic eruption to fully reestablish itself to the pre-eruption period. That's what it looks like we're dealing with right now. So that's interesting. Now, some of the other things that occurred with the eruption. So typically volcanic eruptions, the most abundant gases they have are water vapor, H2O, carbon dioxide, CO2, sulfur dioxide, SO2, hydrogen sulfide, hydrogen chloride, hydrogen fluoride, and other trace gases. But that's typically what's in there. And one of the dangers with volcanic eruptions and the gas clouds is that there's an invisible danger, right? A lot of the volcanic gases are colorless and odorless, and that makes them an invisible hazard. So what will happen is, so CO2 and H2S, those are denser than air, and they can pond in low-lying areas, and they pose a suffocation hazard. You don't know that you're not breathing, right? You're breathing, but you're not getting oxygen. And likewise, SO2 can form aerosols that scatter sunlight, and that can have a global cooling effect on the immediate area. And then, of course, there's the corrosive nature of sulfur and halogen gases, right? They can form acids, sulfuric acid, hydrochloric acid, etc. And those are really corrosive, and they can make their way back to the surface.